It's Magnum Podcast. I'm Jason Snell, joined as always by Philip Michaels and David J. Lohr. Hi, guys.
Just you wait, Jonathan Quayle Higgins. Just you wait.
Now repeat after me one more time.
The
Wahoo on Oahu spends all his money on Yahoo.
The Wahoo on Oahu.
Don't drop the H now.
Oh, Oahu.
Hello, Governor. Is it time for the Magnum?
This is our new segment.
No more segments. We got lots of feedback from the podcast police last week. Too many segments. What we call segments are literally just things we talk about. They're not segments.
There's just no such thing.
The Gaia on the Lanai ate all of my papaya. Eat after me.
What's all this, then?
Zowie on Maui. We are too much Maui Wowie.
We are talking about Professor Jonathan Higgins, Season 5, Episode 13. And I want to make a confession, which is when you guys picked this episode for us to watch, I thought this was one of those episodes where Higgins' second cousin, also played by John Hillerman, comes and the wacky, you know, double split screens and double plots ensue. And I'm watching it, waiting for that to happen. And instead, a different Higgins relative shows up. Exactly. Looks nothing like John Hillerman. And I'm thinking, what is going on here? And then
it's amazing acting.
Then the penny drops and I realize, oh, it's Professor Jonathan Higgins, like Professor Henry Higgins, because we're going to do Pygmalion here.
We're going to do Higmalion.
Is that what you... Yeah. Are gonna okay? Anyway, it's My Fair Lady, yeah, is what I'm saying.
My fair second cousin once removed. Yes.
Fifth. Well, he says it's five times removed, which is not possible. That's like five generations off. That's not. It's nonsense. By the way, I'll just say now. My first note while watching this entire episode was just, this is not a serious show. It's not a serious show. It's Magnum. This is a ridiculous episode, and yet incredibly fun, and to the point where I would say this is the kind of episode where if you watch this episode and you say, no, this is ridiculous, it's like, friend, you're not getting it. It is ridiculous. If you're like, I thought this was like a punch 'em up, rough 'em up detective show where he solves crimes and all that, it's like, yeah, it's not really about that.
There's some
punch 'em up, there's some gunfire, and
like, this is a series where it was like a Trojan horse with all the punch 'em up, and then everything else came out afterwards.
Yeah, and the rest of it is ridiculous. Or maybe I'll get to it later. Okay, I won't. Or as they say on the side of a Ms. Peroni's frozen pizza box, Ms. Peroni's for a hot slice of life. In this episode, Magnum wins a contest for his favorite frozen pizza, where he finishes in fourth place and gets to go to Disney World, but with no flights. So he's going to have to raise the money for that, because he came up with the fourth best slogan for Mrs. Peroni's frozen pizza, and spends the entire episode trying to extort basically money out of various people to pay him in plane tickets so that he and his buddies Rick and TC can go to the Magic Kingdom and... hang out with David Duck, Darling Duck. What does Higgins call him?
David Duck.
David Duck. Yes, the KKK Grand Wizard, David Duck.
Yeah.
So, the
primary person that Magnum is going to exploit to fund his adventure is poor Agatha Chumley.
Agatha Chumley, who is a victim of a $10,000 timeshare real estate investment scam that leads to the tragedy of the bake sale, where Agatha Chumley and her friends are driving in their car to go to the delightful moment where they're going to contribute the money to charity or whatever, and there's a whole group assembled there to discover that they've been scammed. And the rest of the episode, Magnum's trying to trace back through a whole series of shell corporations who stole Agatha Chumley's money, while also trying to get her to pay for his plane ticket to Florida.
Who's lost all of her Club's money. It was Agatha all along.
Oh, yes, it's such it's a modern reference, Phil. Yeah, so well, just
I was not expecting.
If we were doing segments, I would call this the Phil Watches a Show from the 21st Century segment. Yeah. But we're not doing those anymore, so I can't do it.
How about that, huh?
Good job! Wow.
Thank you.
Anyway, bake sale tragedy is what I'm saying. So, so the other thing that happens in this episode that, there's so much good stuff in this episode. We get some Magnum narration that is deep. Okay. It's like a thing in Magnum PI where Tom Selleck's really good at giving narration. And sometimes the narration is really serious and it makes you think, and it's kind of well done kind of noir detective, stuff. And then there's sometimes it's ridiculous. Like, you know, I hate getting up early, but sometimes I do get up early, like once a week, and I do it so I can get the mail. I look at a sunrise, there's rainbows, and then I get the mail. It's great.
I love getting mail, and I get the mail before Higgins. Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah. Also that we can see a shot of Magnum getting the mail, and then Higgins going, "What's in the mail, Magnum?"
Well, he goes, "I did it! I did it!" He goes, yeah. "Yes, you got the mail all by yourself, Magnum. Very good. I'm very proud of you."
It's just, I love... Like, obviously, Jay Hughley, who wrote this episode, it was like, how am I going to do this where Magnum gets the letter saying that he's won the Mrs. Peroni's frozen pizza contest? And the answer was, I know, a voiceover.
He gets up early, but Magnum never gets up early. This time he does, friend.
I'm telling you, once a week he has an early day where he... sees the sunrise, well, looks at the rainbows, and gets the mail, because the mail comes very early at the estate, apparently. Very early.
I was just going to say, he's very sensitive about seeing the sunrise. So
that's true.
Oh,
I get it. He's depressed, and this pizza thing is the one thing that has cheered him up.
Yeah. This episode does a lot with the thing that is one of the most consistently weird things about the show, which is, by all accounts, Magnum should be the schlubbiest loser possible.
Yeah.
And then it's Tom Selleck. And like he's always written as a loser and a failure.
Yes.
And he's not even very good as a detective, although he tries hard. But Tom Selleck's so good that that is the internal conflict. It's this, you know, handsome, muscular guy, and we're supposed to believe he's a schlub, but he's not. So what does that mean? And this episode does a lot of that, perhaps no better than in the scene where Magnum goes to the timeshare / con office and is really excited that there's a battery operated popcorn popper, which he then misuses and gets popcorn all over the Ferrari.
He overfilled it and he talks to it.
He does talk to it while talking to Higgins. Higgins gets very upset because he's like, Higgins is saying, Magnum, are you talking to me or are you talking to the popcorn? And the answer is mostly the popcorn, Higgins, turns out.
Well, it's not even that. When he hangs up and Agatha is like, what was that all about? He goes, apparently Magnum has invented some kind of machine by which he can discover it. And it's like, what?
Yeah.
You don't believe that. Stop that.
Yeah. He's got some sort of crime-solving machine.
I wrote that down because I love that.
And Higgins is really upset because Magnum is on the case that Agatha has hired Magnum to solve this case. And I think Higgins feels like he should do it because he feels that, you know, he should take care of her and defend her and all of that. And also
he feels that Magnum is using this to kick about the property at the same time that Higgins is about to. In the main plot of this.
Oh man, yeah, we haven't even gotten to My Fair Lady yet.
greet his cousin
five times removed. Yes.
From the family he admires most in the world, and oh, Magnum, your boorishness will put her off.
Yeah, so she's about to come in, but before she does that, before she arrives, he's super stressed out, and in a moment that I really liked, Agatha says, oh, Jonathan, you really must relax. And I thought, is this where they got the idea for that new age wine orgy thing that we talked about in a previous episode? Maybe so. Maybe that's how she gets him to relax.
No, you just have to.
Coincidentally.
Coincidentally
with the same.
We let the fruit ferment too long. That was, she planned it. is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
You have to just go into every Agatha Higgins interaction with the thought that Agatha is, this is it. This is finally the moment I get to jump on Higgins and break it off.
Yep.
And then just boom. And then now you'll see the sunrise in the morning, Higgins.
Yeah.
Oh, the mental image.
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. It's always there. It's always there.
Yep.
It's either, depending on the episode, it's either that she's lying in wait for that moment to spring, or it's that, or some episodes I feel like they are up to the filthiest stuff right off screen, and then they come on and they're like, oh, no, nothing is happening. We're fine. I go back and forth there. I know that's not canonical, but I like to think that they're having a good time sometimes. So Sally Ponte arrives. Sally Ponting is Higgins's murmur cousin. He thinks that she is this fancy cousin. Turns out though, a taxi drives her up. She gets out. She's got orange hair. She's dressed like, what did you say, Phil? Dressed like what a middle-aged costume designer for a TV show thinks that a punk rocker would be dressed like?
Yeah, about the same time, we've been working our way through the Muppet Show back catalog on Disney. In the last season, Debbie Harry was the host, or the guest star.
Right.
And they have a scene where she's performing, basically, punk rock Muppets invade the Muppet Show, is the conceit of that. And those puppets with their crazy hair and their rubber bands stuck in their face, they look more realistic as punk rockers than Sally Ponting does in her human scenes.
So, yeah.
She looks like she stepped off the set of Square Pegs.
It's 85, right? So the punk scene is already kind of old news.
It's dead.
It's gone. And yet this is sort of what they're getting at here. I don't know if they ever say that she's an actual punk, or if she's just sort of because she's a barmaid, or this is just sort of like a look that she's decided to go with. But anyway, it is kind of ridiculous as looks go, in being kind of over the top, but also not quite right. My favorite touch here is that, how do we know that she's a punk? It's not just the orange hair and the makeup and the clothing. It's also that she's riding the whole way in the cab with her boombox playing, and it's playing, I would call it rockabilly. It's playing, again, what a 50-year-old man in 1985 thinks is punk rock, which is to say, Perry Como. So,
it sounds like those Stray Cats my kid is listening.
Mm-hmm.
I hate those Stray Cats.
Yeah. What are they thinking? That's not music.
And every time they did a close-up of her in the orange wig, because I assume it was a wig.
Right.
She looks like she's in costume for Cats,
yes,
which is funny because that's where Selleck first met
her. That's right. This is Jillie Mack, who's already been in an episode that we talked about. This is Mrs. Tom Selleck to this day. They met because when shooting that London episode.
Lassiter.
Oh, was it Lassiter? I thought it was the London episode. No, it was Lassiter. Okay. Well, when he was shooting in London, he went to see Cats and was taken by her, and they met, and then they got married, and she was in multiple Magnum episodes, usually as the English one. This, I think, her most substantial role, although I will always love her in that episode where she's just the English girl at the party, at Rick and TC's party in Magnum's place, which is when the wine, the fruit fermented too long and the wine went off and there was the whole literary meditation orgy thing happening simultaneously. That is a classic episode if ever there was one. But here she is, she's doing a exaggerated and apparently, not very good Cockney accent as our target for this My Fair Lady thing. And so the whole idea here is, oh no, she'll never be accepted by her fiancé's family, who are all right and proper, and Higgins is going to have to do that thing where, like in My Fair Lady, they're going to have to teach her to talk right and dress right and look right over the course of a very short period of time. And I also have a hard time believing that she would have no knowledge of what, like, proper pronunciation is like, even if she doesn't normally do it. But she seems to be, the character seems to be portrayed as having no awareness that everybody does not speak exactly like her, which I find
there's a scene where she pours tea for people.
Yes.
And
scenes where she pours tea for
several.
People.
You know, there's like more than that.
I'm not a tea guy. I don't know tea, but I do know how to pour a drink from a kettle.
She's
supposedly a bartender.
Right.
Yeah.
And yet she doesn't know how to pour a drink.
If you have three teacups, what you do is you take sugar and you just pour it across them and it also lands on the tray and in the saucer. And then you pour the tea the same way, just kind of like let it go across. Well, that is a more sitcom-y kind of moment in this.
I mean, Curly Howard or Shemp Howard would do it
that way. Yeah, it is. It is pretty extreme.
That's not really a matter of poor breeding. That's a matter of just, she's a cartoon character at that point.
My favorite touch, by the way, about punk rocker Sally is that she's got a lot of jewelry and stuff. Whoever did the looping in this episode, there every time she's on screen and moving even a little bit, there are so many little jingling sounds. It's great. It's really, I was very impressed. Like, you get the idea that literally she can't move even a little bit without all of her jewelry just kind of jingling. I thought that was really, really well done. So yeah, they're gonna.
Yeah, the backstory is she works in a pub. She met this fella in the pub who apparently is prim and proper, but let his hair down. And now he's in love with her, and now she's come to meet the mother who lives in Hawaii, and she's the kind of woman who Margaret Dumont looks at and goes, "Oh, you're very uptight.
Yeah,
you need to loosen a few buttons."
Yes, that's right, Mrs. Finch.
Yes.
Mrs. Finch, who's like, I would like my son to marry a girl from the Buxley Finishing School, which Higgins invented for her, which is a nice little twist. meanwhile, Magnum is on the case. He uses Rick. There's a bunch of hot typewriters at this one place. I thought that was really funny, the idea that there's a big commodity market for stolen typewriters. I think that's... amazing. There is a fight. We find out that Frank Omar is this guy who is probably at the head of the pyramid scheme. And there's, you know, fighting and some gunplay that I had several moments where I thought, boy, this would be a really stupid way for Magnum to die. You know, he'll die in a stupid way, but it'll take a couple more seasons. So that's fine. They have the wedding luncheon. And this is the moment where they've kind of like they've gotten her hair to be white, you know, blonde instead of so they've sort of bleached it out. And they get her a wig on top of that, and they've gotten her to speak better. And it starts out okay, but then Higgins goes away, and we get that scene where like Agatha watches in horror as she becomes increasingly more of herself, and the whole thing
gets drunker.
Yes, and the whole thing kind of falls. It goes off the rails. And she sadly says, "Oh, they like me for who I am." And it's like, no, they don't. It's very sad. So a deal nonsensically is struck, which is that she needs to behave like a true Buxley girl by the day before the wedding, or the wedding is off. At which point Magnum appears and says, "Hey, everybody, this is kind of like the plot of that movie, you know, My Fair Lady." Thanks, Magnum.
This was the scene that nearly killed the episode for me, because... again, Magnum, we are not sitting in a cave watching shadows, not knowing what magical thing we're looking at. Even in 1985, people knew what the hell My Fair Lady was.
Well, and I love the fact that, you know, okay, we're going to just hang that lantern right there, right?
We're going to use the lantern to set the entire scene on fire with that lantern we hung.
And then
down
Higgins
the village with the lantern.
To show how much smarter and more intellectual he is than Magnum is like, oh no, it's Pygmalion.
That is the saving grace of that scene. Is that that Higgins out?
I love that
he Higgins is Magnum there, but the Magnum part, it's like.
Although there's also this moment where Magnum goes, "This is just like that play, My Fair Lady," and for a moment, people are all, "What? I don't see it at all, huh? What are you talking about, Magnum?
You know, Audrey Hepburn, and you're Henry Higgins instead of Jonathan Higgins, and it's Magnum.
Thank you.
Got it."
I, too, have Leonard Moulton's video review guide. Thank you.
Now, wouldn't it be great if Magnum were played by Wilfred Hyde White? Anyway.
We now get one of the great moments, classic Magnum moments, where Magnum recruits his friends, who are very bad at this, to yes. go in with him on various schemes. In this case, TC puts on a very nice light suit and says, I work for the IRS, but I do not have any ID. And basically the idea is, TC, just act like you're an IRS guy and stall him while I break into the back and go through the records of this shell corporation and all of that. And of course, TC, spectacularly bad at it, is immediately called out for it and only escapes because he...
He swings his briefcase at the guy.
And hits the guy with a gun and then runs into the back room where Thomas is supposed to be, but he's not there anymore, and then runs out the back door and then into the Ferrari where Thomas is going to tell him a whole story. And he's like, Thomas, no, really, there's guys who are going to kill us, so we should
and
go.
And he's like, no, TC, I've got Chekhov's exposition right here, and I'm going to say the number 818 and no one's going to notice at all. And then, we should drive.
We should drive because those guys are now out here with their guns shooting at us. And again, this would be a very stupid way for Thomas Magnum to die because he was telling a story to TC when he should have been driving.
The best thing about that scene, and it happens anytime TC has to do undercover work, and I give full credit to Roger Mosley for what I hope is a conscious character decision on his part. TC adopts this voice hello, I am from the Internal Revenue.
Yeah. No, it's so great. It's so great because before, and they make the point of having him be like, all right, Thomas, okay, I'll do it. And he's like, hello, yes, I am with the Internal Revenue Service, and I am here today to consult you about your books. And it's so good because he's so bad at this. That's so great.
That's why I love Magnum, is that you're so trained in all of these shows, especially in the 70s and 80s, that everybody is so good at it and they're going to get away with it because they're the heroes. And on Magnum, it's just dumb luck.
Yeah. So
I love it.
Pep talks and learning and all these things. And it's like, okay, we've gotten Sally ready to go. She's like, oh, this is terrible. I'm never going to be able to hold up to the standards of the Boxley finishing school. And this is when Higgins says, I made it up. It's not real, which is great. And no. She's like, oh, Higgins.
Now, before you get too far, so they had to negotiate with the
yes.
soon-to-be mother-in-law.
Yes, because the last we heard, she needed to be convinced on the day before the wedding. We never see that.
They have 2 days, and then I will meet with her, and that scene never appears.
Nope. No, because now it's they're about to go into the wedding chapel when this pep talk happens, because it's been, apparently she passed that test, and now it's the final test, is that the groom needs to approve of what they've done with her or whatever. But anyway, no time to think about it, because we're going into the chapel, to which I say, I do? Because it's the same chapel as in the episode that we talked about where Magnum gets married in that fake marriage. It's the exact same place. Anyway, where's the groom? He's not there. He leaves poor Sally at the altar. She's very upset. And this leads to, again, like we talked about last week, one of the great like little shifts in tone that this show can do, where it's been ludicrous and then it has some moments of real, I think, emotional clarity and just very well done stuff, which is a long talk with Higgins and Sally about her identity and about she doesn't know who she really is, and she kind of likes some of the things that they've been doing, and she's not who she was before, but she's also not this person that they're trying to make her into, and what's she really going to do? And he is apologetic for saying, well, you know, I forced you down this path, and she says, I didn't say no, I didn't try to stop you. And it's just, again, one of these scenes where they do this scene, and I think, well, wait a second. How did this really nice scene happen in the middle of all this of TC? Like, literally, 5 minutes ago, TC was going, hello there, I am from the IRS. And then you have this.
And it's like, we in another show, in another series, we talked about Moonlighting's Taming of the Shrew episode that kind of fixes the problem with Taming of the Shrew. And this kind of fixes that weird little imbalance in Pygmalion and My Fair Lady. There's not really a moment where they come to that kind of emotional clarity in My Fair Lady. It's here.
Right.
And it's like, what?
Yeah. Yeah. I like it. I like that she gets to have that. Like, again, because, you know, she's introduced as a very silly exaggeration. And here you see her. I mean, and it's all shorthand because this is a 1 hour TV episode, right? And she's only the A plot. There's also a B plot involving Thomas. So she doesn't get a lot of time, but this is a really good kind of moment to flesh her out and have her say, well, no, I'm a person and I'm more than I was maybe. And I've thought about being, you know, part of a wider world, but I'm also not this stereotype that you're making me into. And I really need to decide who I am as a person. And, you know, after being left at the altar, I like it. I like it. I think it's very well done. And I think that Jillie Mack does a good job.
Yeah. It's her best scene in the episode.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Some of the other stuff she's doing.
Well, yeah, this is really she's asked to do a lot of ridiculous stuff.
Yes.
And she just does it over the top.
And speak in an accent that is not her own.
No, because she is English, but not an over-the-top Cockney accented person. So,
right, exactly.
So, nor again, and then the punk rock, fake punk rock clothes and all of those things.
But the denim is very good, where they have they show up at Magnum shows up at the property to confront the people, and it's the runaway groom.
So this is
well, it turns out he gets dragooned into finding the runaway groom instead of finishing up Agatha's thing,
right.
But then realizes the runaway groom is at 818 something something, and goes, wait, that number's
yeah,
the
this
same
is that
number.
Moment where Thomas is like, oh, and now it all comes together. And I'll say, I think this is kind of a dumb twist. Why do these two things have to be related? It seems like
it makes no sense. I have in my notes three times, it makes no sense.
It's the law of conservation of capers.
Yes,
you can only have so many capers in one island.
Yeah,
and you know, you build to him having that narration of I can't see any good way out of this.
Right, he feels bad about
and
it, which
it's actually a not bad. Little...
Yeah, the emotional resonance of it is good, that he realizes that this is actually going to converge his two plot lines in a way that, and that's a very Magnum PI thing, and in a way that's bad, and it's going to be bad for her, and he feels bad about it. But it does lead to a really kind of fun 1-2 punch scene where it's revealed that the runaway groom is actually the bad guy who's the con man, and that she's going to go, Sally's going to go with him, and they're like, oh, life of crime, here we go. And they're like, oh, Sally, how could you? And she's like, you know, I'm going to go off with my boyfriend. And she goes outside, and then you hear the crash of the bottle because she smashed a bottle over his head, because Sally has had that talk with Higgins, and we know that she's good after all. And then the sound of the breaking glass is enough for them to punch the guy, the man, the henchman, who's got his gun pointed at them. And it all works out. Those guys are going to be taken to the pokey. And instead, what happens? She decides to stay in Hawaii at Bit of Britain, an English-themed pub in Honolulu, where she gets to serve pints to tourists and also Higgins, Magnum, and the gang, and figure out her place in the world,
again.
Which is kind of a nice end for her, actually, at the ridiculous
really
Bit of Britain pub. And then Magnum is handed a information that he's actually been promoted to the third place prize in the Mrs. Peroni's Frozen Pizza Contest, all expenses paid, trip to Hawaii. Higgins makes a joke in a Cockney accent, the end.
And so the guy who turns out to be the con man, who is the son of the woman who apparently is his mother, why do they seem to be the same age? That was really weird.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Yeah. No, that part is just attached to this story because they need a resolution that is sort of a detective crime resolution, but it doesn't really it doesn't hold up under scrutiny. Like, I'm going to go back to my previous statement at the top of this episode, which is this is not a serious show.
And I want to know what the other prizes were, that the fourth prize is a trip to Disney World.
Yeah, back in 1985, Disney World was quite exotic, because Epcot had just opened, and David Duck was wandering
about the
property, and it was...
No pants.
Talking about the superiority of white ducks, as he did. Uh-huh.
Those aren't just feathers.
Mallards are an abomination in God's eyes. No, David Duck, please. Oh, God, no.
And that's when he moved to Louisiana and ran for Congress.
Exactly.
I like the Bit of Britain thing. I think it's cute. Again, that's the stuff that is good here, is the kind of emotional resonance of that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, there would be a terrible pub in Honolulu.
Oh, undoubtedly.
Oh, totally.
Undoubtedly. And that was it, right? They had the old English script on the outside, and it's like, hello, governor, wouldn't you like a pint? I'm like, yeah, you got to have that. And all the expats will go in there, and they'll be delighted to find that there's an actual barmaid who is from England who's going to serve them their pint, right. And they're going to be happy, and the locals are going to love it, and the tourists are going to love it. And that's my headcanon for Sally Ponting, is that she ended up buying the bit of Britain and was a successful businesswoman.
It is a shame that they never go back there in the subsequent seasons.
Yeah, could they not get the actress?
It kind of is.
Yeah, I guess not. You would think that Tom Selleck would be able to summon her.
You would think that at a moment's notice.
Yeah.
You would think that. Yeah, she's not, you know, again, I love her in Rembrandt's Girl, the Carol Burnett episode where she is the new waver at a party, because that new waver at a party scene is amazing for so many reasons.
It's delightful.
But this is good. Yes, they have her do a ridiculous accent and it's silly. And the whole My Fair Lady thing, again, like, we get it. I'm really disappointed when Magnum explains to us what they're doing, because we get it.
Yes, we understand, Magnum.
But her little journey at the end is actually pretty good. It's like there's some I liked it. I was surprised that I actually cared about this ridiculous thing at the end, and that's a nice trick, I think.
I will be an apologist for Magnum, though. I kind of like that he's like, hey, I get the reference, well, and I'm going to explain it to you guys.
If I didn't feel like he was explaining it to the morons in the CBS television viewing public,
I would feel better about it.
And how much was that a network note? Maybe that was the network.
If it was a little, looking from now, of course, I'm going to say this, but like if there was just a little tad more irony, like how Magnum said it was like My Fair Lady, and everybody else looked at him like, I don't get it. I don't see that at all. I don't know what you're talking about, Magnum. I would have taken that. I would have even taken a look at the camera by Magnum like he does sometimes and been like, they're killing me here, essentially, right? Like, you see it, right? Great. Audience, you get it, right? But instead, it's more like, audience, are you aware of My Fair Lady? That's what we're doing here. And it's just like, yeah. I don't know. The tone, it was off. At least Higgins then comes back with, no, it's actually Pygmalion, which is like, okay, yeah. All right.
I see. That's why I think it was like a network note where, like, you have to mention My Fair Lady. And they're like, oh, yeah, well, we'll do that, but we'll do one better. Because the title should have given it away.
Yes.
You know? I didn't know what
it meant, and I thought it was like we were going to meet Professor Jonathan Higgins, and then the moment that she gets there, I'm like, oh, and that's when I texted you guys, and I was like, oh, I see now, I see it. That's all it took. That's really all it took. But yeah, I would have just a little more subtle would have been nice, and or if only Magnum sees the very obvious parallel, that would have been funny. But instead, it's like, hello, everybody. Have you heard? I'm sure you've heard of My Fair Lady and Audrey Hepburn. Let me read the IMDb page for My Fair Lady. Okay, we got it.
Yes. Which is actually a physical page in 1985.
Yes. It's,
Higgins,
well,
Higgins,
okay, it's from
let me
the,
bring out,
it's a complete encyclopedia
the puffy
of film.
VHS cup box.
Yeah. The only way that scene could have been more obvious is if they would have had that discussion in a telegraph office.
Actually, actually, it would have been nice if they had at some point driven by a theater playing My Fair Lady in Honolulu. Be like, oh,
there you go.
Oh, but when he says you're Rex Harrison and she's Audrey Hepburn, like, yes, we got it.
And then, you know, when they're getting ready for the wedding and Higgins is like, well, we'd better get you to the church on time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I do. Well, that's Professor Jonathan Higgins. Any final thoughts about this episode?
It's a fun episode.
Yeah.
In spite of and maybe because of its flaws.
And I will bring up the director, Peter Medak, who has had such a kind of a wild career. He went from The Ruling Class with Peter O'Toole and a script by Terry Southern to The Craze and, gosh, what else? Zorro the Gay Blade, go figure, Species 2, and several episodes of Homicide, The Wire, and Breaking Bad.
Hmm. All over the place.
That is an eclectic career.
And The Ghost of Peter Sellers, which is an amazing documentary about ghosts in the noonday sun, a disastrous film he tried to direct, written by Spike Milligan and starring Peter Sellers back in the 70s. He said it's the most disastrous thing he's ever worked on. Great movie. Great, great documentary.
All right. Well, I think we reached the end, but I will remind you all, Magnum at theincomparable.com. Send in your theories, your explanations, your goofs, your trivia.
Try and send them in on a playbill of My Fair Lady from a local production so that we know you're a true fan.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, I have one of those.
I'm sure that you do. Yeah. I knew it the moment it came out of my mouth. I wonder if David has a playbill, Philip. Okay.
Anyway, this has been Magnum Podcast. I've been Jason Snell, and they've been David J. Lohr and Philip Michaels. Goodbye, Governor.
I've grown accustomed to his surf ski.
Come on, Dover, move your bloomin' arse.
Oi!